Chapter 6. Violence and the State. Some historians, inspired by the German sociologist Max Weber, have argued that as states gained a monopoly over violence, as they became more powerful, more centralized, and more bureaucratic, interpersonal violence declined. In other words, the state took charge of justice and made itself responsible for carrying out the punishment of criminals. By assuming responsibility for the exercise of violence, the state was able to reduce levels of violence among ordinary people. It's a powerful argument, and it makes quite a bit of sense, but it does not present us with an entirely accurate understanding of violence and the state. It is also based on the assumption that any reduction of violence must come from above, and that those who are most directly touched by violence have little or no agency. The role of civil society in controlling levels of violence does not appear to play a part in the Weberian model. There are other points that are worth making about the role of the state and violence. The first is that the state, which we will define as an organized political community under a government that rules over a defined territory, always reduces levels of violence. But this is not always the case. Think of warfare, political purges, and state-sponsored genocide. The state's monopolization of violence and state-sponsored genocide around the world has made it one of, if not, the key factors of violence in the 19th and 20th centuries. It includes the Armenian Genocide, collectivization in the Soviet Union, which resulted in the Great Famine in which millions died, the Holocaust, and the Cambodian Genocide. Think, too, of the Nazi euthanasia program, which resulted in the deaths of up to 200,000 people, and the eugenics program in the United States in the first half of the 20th century that led to over 70,000 women being forcibly sterilized. Then there is the sociologist Mark Cooney's argument that as the state's power increased and as some forms of violence declined, other forms became much more private. That is, violence simply evolved and changed, not just quantitatively, but also qualitatively. This chapter will focus on four themes: colonialism, state-sanctioned violence, extreme violence against civilians in warfare, and terrorism. Political violence can take many forms, including extra-legal warfare, ethnic cleansing, civil war, terrorism, and state repression, revolution, and counter-revolution. It can also encompass state as well as non-state actors and acts of violence that might be carried out for political, secular, or religious reasons. We also need to make a distinction between violence and warfare, interconnected but different phenomena. I looked at rape in warfare in Chapter 5, so I'll limit my remarks here to the kinds of violence that often accompany organized warfare, such as massacres and atrocities, the role of race, and the increased technological potential to kill larger numbers of people, both combatant and non-combatant. There will be some inevitable and unavoidable overlap, but violence is not something that can be clearly categorized and contained. Colonialism, race, and violence. Violence has always been central to the long, complex history of colonialism that stretches back centuries. Colonial violence was diffuse, multi-layered, and varied enormously. But as a rule, as interpersonal violence in Europe declined, in the modern era, levels of violence against non-Europeans in the colonies increased. While violence is far from unique to colonial practices, it was always embedded in the social, legal, economic, and gendered foundations on which colonial relations were built. A broad distinction can be made between exploitative colonialism and settler colonialism. Exploitative colonialism was predicated on extracting primary resources and labour from colonised territories for the benefit of the imperial centre. This was the case for the British Raj. Settler colonialism was predicated on taking possession of new territories and transporting people from the metropole to the colonies, as well as the exploitation and extraction of resources for the metropole. This was the case for countries like Australia, New Zealand, and regions like Africa and the Americas. By its very nature, then, colonization involved the subjugation of people and their lands, cultures, and laws. The justification was that Europeans were bringing civilization and enlightenment to savages and primitive people. The use of pervasive and everyday violence was also justified on the grounds that indigenous were ignorant. But race too had a role to play in this violence. Europeans often looked upon indigenous as vermin. Revolts and rebellions often met with brutal repression. The mutiny of 1857 in India is a case in point. But there are countless examples from the European and American colonizing experiences in which punitive colonial campaigns of varying levels of intensity ruthlessly put down rebellions and unrest. An array of violent strategies was used by European colonial powers to dominate the rest of the world throughout the latter part of the 19th and into the 20th centuries. Martial law, paramilitary policing, and corporal punishment were extensively used by imperial states to maintain control of indigenous peoples. While settlers carried out massacres on the colonial frontier against local peoples who opposed incursions onto their territory, indigenous and local peoples in turn resisted, sometimes in haphazard ways. After the Second World War, in what became known as Wars of Independence, or Wars of Decolonization against the European powers, the colonized revolted against the colonizer in national movements throughout Africa and Asia. Most of the violence carried out by colonial powers against the colonized remains unrecorded. Skirmishes, small confrontations, and massacres on the frontier, for example, were often overlooked or simply not reported, and were never considered to be part of ongoing wars against the colonized. In fact, there have been very few attempts to count the number of clashes that took place across European and American colonial possessions. During Queen Victoria's reign, at least 228 known armed conflicts took place across the British Empire, from 1837 to 1901, a figure that vastly underestimates the number of small battles and forms of guerrilla warfare that were fought on colonial frontiers. Over the same era, for example, potentially hundreds of skirmishes were fought on the Australian frontier alone, some of them recorded only indirectly, and many of them not recorded at all. This code of silence among murdering settlers has a history too. Thus, the squatter, Henry Merrick, writing of Victoria in the 1840s in Life in the Bush, noted how Aboriginal people were hunted down. Men, women and children were shot whenever they can be met with. I have protested against it at every station I have been in the strongest language. But these things are kept very secret, as the penalty would certainly be hanging. This code of silence was not peculiar to Australia, and had a role to play in settler violence in North America and South Africa. All settler societies seem to have several characteristics in common. First, wherever settler societies encountered indigenous peoples, killing and massacres occurred. In North Africa, and more specifically Algeria, the French military used razors, a tactic of swift and brutal raids conducted against recalcitrant Algerian communities to repress all resistance. We do not know how many Algerians died in the 19th century wars of conquest, but scholars have suggested anywhere between 500,000 and 1 million out of an estimated 3 million Algerians. Second, the frequency of colonial reprisals and massacres increased throughout the 19th century with the intensification of the European Empire's territorial ambitions. Third, colonial violence often occurred on such a small scale that it could be hidden from metropolitan oversight, but sometimes it occurred on a disturbingly large scale and was openly or implicitly condoned, or sometimes retrospectively condemned by the colonial state. Such was the case for the Amritsar Julian Waller Bar massacre of 1919, in which the British Indian Army fired upon crowds of peaceful protesters, resulting in casualties thought to be in the range of 1,000 to 1,500. Massacres, brute force, the elimination of indigenous peoples, and the repression of resistance to colonial insertions are the most obvious forms of violence used by settlers on the frontier. But as Patrick Wolfe has famously argued, not all strategies geared towards the elimination of the native required the use of physical force. The European imperial state had a wide array of policies to regulate indigenous peoples, including institutional violence and cultural coercion directed at the dissolution of indigenous societies. These coercive strategies, including officially encouraged miscegenation, which authorities around the colonial world believed would lead to the disappearance of indigenous bloodlines, programs of religious conversion, the removal of indigenous children from their families for placement in missions or training schools, and prohibitions against speaking indigenous languages. These programs were designed to ultimately absorb indigenous people into the colonial body politic, to assimilate them so that they would eventually become white. The colonial state was also built and managed through a variety of other violent strategies, but here I will focus on four. First, colonial governors declared martial law throughout the British and French empires, when unruly frontiers could not be brought to order through ordinary legal means. From the mid-19th century, with the arrival of colonial self-government, martial law took on more clearly draconian roles to repress insurgency, to control indigenous subjects, or to contain settler demands. In 1865, for example, Jamaica's Governor Edward John Eyre used the authority of martial law to put to death 439 indigenous insurgents during the Morant Bay Rebellion. Although this event outraged liberals in the metropole, who attempted to have him convicted of murder on three separate occasions, Eyre was acquitted. Second, paramilitary police forces, which included the widespread use of native forces, enabled colonial governments to extend their control over resistant indigenous populations in ways that civil policing could not. In this sense, while paramilitary police forces varied in composition across different colonial settings, they shared a fundamental role to build and protect the economic and political goals of empire. Strategies of colonial policing ranged along a spectrum. As historian Richard Price has pointed out, from the benignly hegemonic to the overtly coercive, but their purpose was always to enforce the laws of the ruling colonial power. Third, the flogging of indigenous peoples remained a normal aspect of many colonial societies, despite humanitarian reforms over the 19th century that saw its use decline for other subjects of empire. In South Africa, for example, about 4,000 men were sentenced to receive cuts or lashes between 1911 and 1914 alone. Sometimes the recipients of these discretionary punishments were flogged to death. But although such cases produced moral outrage in the metropole, they had little impact in reining in the behaviour of settlers who considered it their right to control their workers as they saw fit. More widely, corporal punishment took some extreme forms. In King Leopold's Congo, for instance, where the line between private and state-sanctioned violence was blurred, the amputation of workers' hands and limbs was practiced as a form of punishment on those who did not meet rubber quotas. Even young children were not spared. Between 1880 and 1920, around 10 million people were murdered, worked or starved to death in the Congo. The whole country may have been the personal property of the Belgian king, but the violence was committed at the local level with the complicity of government authorities. The idea of corporal punishment and the instilling of terror was consistent with the notion that severe punishment was integral to reform, that a just measure of pain was necessary to modify criminal behaviour. Salutary terror, violence intended to condition good behaviour in indigenous peoples, was the point at which state violence legitimised settler violence. It normalised coercion as a necessary part of the pacifying civilian process. Whether authorities by colonial states or committed covertly, violence had become such an extensive strategy of conquest by the late 19th and early 20th centuries that scholars had linked the colonial project to the elimination of indigenous peoples. This line of inquiry has also produced some controversial debates about the purported genocidal nature of colonialism and its links to the Nazi Holocaust. Finally, hunger was also used as a tactic to control local populations. There were three famine periods, 1876 to 8, 1896 to 7, and again in 1899 to 1902 that affected different parts of the world, including India and China, but also Korea, Vietnam, the Philippines, and Brazil, regions where minimal human subsistence diets were introduced by colonial authorities and which, as a result, led to the death of anywhere between 32 and 61 million people. In southern Tanzania in the 1890s, the German military systematically destroyed fields and granaries. The tactical use of hunger to control local populations was, according to some historians, the result of Malthusian economic policies. The idea that population always outgrows food supplies, so that populations need to be controlled. Hunger was also a strategy imported back to Europe, used during the First World War when the Allies blockaded Germany to starve the population. The blockade continued after the guns had fallen silent to pressure Germany to sign a treaty, so that at least 400,000 Germans starved to death in 1918. We have also seen the Soviet and Chinese communist states practicing hunger as a means of controlling or eliminating sections of their own populations with enormously devastating consequences. The concentration camp. This leads us to a discussion about the links between colonialism and the concentration camp. After all, the concentration camp emerged not in Europe but among European powers incarcerating locals in the colonies. An argument could be made that the modern concentration camp had its predecessor in the state-run camps for indigenous people in North America and Australia in the 19th century. The conditions in these proto-camps were similar to the modern concentration camp. Disease, malnutrition, exposure to the elements, and unsanitary conditions led to high mortality rates. governments often deliberately withheld support or allowed mismanagement in the hope that the indigenous populations would die. In the late 19th century, colonial wars, the modern camp, as we understand it, emerged when local people were deliberately isolated so as not to lead support to anti-colonial or guerrilla movements. This was a tactic adopted by the Spanish in the Cuban War of Independence, the Americans in the Philippines, the British during the Boer War, along with the widespread use of a product originally meant for farming called barbed wire, and the Germans in Southwest Africa. In each case, tens of thousands of civilians died from disease and malnutrition. Given the time frame, it is worth asking whether European powers learned from one another or whether the practices specific in the camps, torture, forced labour, hunger, emerged independently at the same time in different regions of the globe. The answer to that question is complicated by the fact that there is no typical concentration camp. The nature and purpose of the camp can vary enormously from the British concentration camps in South Africa through to the Soviet Gulag, the German system of Gesellschaftsschlenzleiner in occupied Europe, or the internment of Japanese in the United States during the Second World War. They are all camps, but they each had a different purpose. The use of camps expanded dramatically during the First World War. Millions of citizens, enemy aliens, as well as nationals who had been stripped of their citizenship, were interned, as were millions of POWs, often in conditions that led to a high number of deaths. In the case of the American genocide, we see the development, for the first time, of death camps. During the interwar years in Europe, we see the construction of camps to isolate undesirables and asocials, ethnic or political, from the rest of the population. This occurred after Europe's multinational empires had collapsed and when new nation-states were attempting to build new societies based on new ideologies. The Soviet Gulag was the exemplar for this kind of camp, and may have been the model for the Nazi concentration camp system. There are no definitive figures for Soviet Russia, but archival evidence points to the development of a complex system of prisons, labour camps, labour colonies and special settlements. As many as 18 million people passed through the hundreds of labour camps and colonies between 1930 and 1953. Of which an estimated 1.6 million died in the camps, and possibly millions more after being released in poor health from the camp system. Another 800,000 people were executed in various purges between 1921 and 1953. Researchers at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum recently documented 42,500 ghettos and concentration camps built by the Nazis between 1933 and 1945, a figure far higher than previously thought. The Nazis built death camps from the end of 1941, Chelmno, Belzig, Sobibor, Treblinka, Majdanek, and Auschwitz-Birkenau, but in Nazi ideology, ethnically undesirable inmates were never seen as a source of slave labour. They were used for labour, but the goal was not to preserve their lives for the war effort, but to work the inmates to death. They were not so much part of the war economy, but lives to be wasted. If the Spanish and British policies led to inadvertent deaths, the Nazis intended to starve the Jews and Slavs to death through precisely calculated starvation diets. More than 3 million Soviet POWs died in German camps, mostly from starvation and disease. It is estimated that over 1 million German POWs died in Soviet captivity, about one-third of the German POWs held by the Soviets. After the Second World War, the use of camps continued in countries where the colonized were fighting for independence. such as Algeria, Malaya, and Kenya as a means of dictatorships to isolate political opponents such as Spain and Argentina, as well as in the newly formed and often communist states. China and North Korea have concentration camp systems that persist to this day, systems in which the camp is not only used as a means of re-educating individuals and reshaping society, but has also become part and parcel of the forced labour economy. The camp, therefore, serves many purposes, but it tells us that the modern state is prepared to intern, as well as kill or let die, millions of its own people to strengthen or maintain its hold on power. If millions died in the camps, however, millions were also killed by rifle and machine gun fire or died of starvation in the killing fields, Ottoman, German, and Russian of Europe. Genocide. Genocides have existed throughout history, and they invariably happen as a result of a process of dehumanizing that takes place before genocidal killing begins. Whether we are talking about American Indians, the Herero, Armenians, Jews, or Tutsis, the killers were conditioned to look upon people as lice, cockroaches, and vermin that needed to be eradicated. Modern genocides, however, raise larger questions about the nature of the state and the relationship of the state to its citizens. In the modern era, mass violence, in the years leading up to the outbreak of the First World War, was largely over religious, ethnic questions as states began to embrace national identities and began to exclude those they now consider other or enemies of the state. The trend continued after the First World War, when there was the possibility of a massive ethnic reorganization, a redrawing of the map, that led to new national forces imposing their new national ethnic identities onto the people of the borderland regions in question. The first of these occurred in the Ottoman Empire in the summer of 1915. With the decision made by the Committee of Union and Progress, CUP, to deport and then to exterminate the Armenian people. In 1929, Stalin began the collectivization of agricultural land that rapidly evolved into a class war against kulaks. Hitler's recording of the Central and Eastern Europe was limited by his failure to defeat the Soviets in 1941. The Nazis had decided on a massive program of colonization and resettlement of Eastern Europe, even before Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941. This is known as the General Plan, Ost, which foresaw the displacement of anywhere between 30 and 50 million people, many of whom were expected to die. That is, genocide was implicit in the plan. The brutal reality was that at least 10 million people were killed in the Nazi camp system between 1933 and 1945, a figure which encompasses the Holocaust. The term genocide was coined in 1944 by a Polish Jewish lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, in a book documenting the Nazi policy of systematically destroying national and ethnic groups, including the mass murder of European Jews. He formed the word by combining geno, from the Greek word for race or tribe, with side, from the Latin word for killing. Noting that the term denoted an old practice in its modern development, Lemkin defined genocide as a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups, with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. In 1948, in the shadow of the Holocaust, and in no small part due to the efforts of Lemkin, the United Nations approved the Convention on the Prevention of Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. This convention establishes genocide as an international crime. which signatory nations undertake to prevent and punish. It defines genocide as A. killing members of the group, B. causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C. deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, D. imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, E. forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. The United Nations definition was very much of its time, that is influenced and modified as a result of the Cold War policies. The Allies made sure that it precluded any accusations of genocide that might have been directed at them, such as the mass killings related to the aerial bombardment, while the Soviets made sure that the crimes notoriously associated with its regime, such as collectivization, mass deportations, or the Stalinist purges, were also excluded. Social and political groups were excluded from the definition. Moreover, not only is the United Nations definition vague, but the in-part qualification discussed earlier makes it even more ambiguous. Since then, scholars have attempted to refine the definition. There are more than 22 in use, and to redefine categories of killing to include terms like ethnic cleansing, politicide, democide, gendercide, ethnocide, and genocidal massacre. Each of these terms, which differentiates between types of violent group action, can be used to describe a specific form of mass killing, but they are all part of the master concept that is genocide. Related to the definition of genocide is the question of intent. While the United Nations definition assumes that genocide is premeditated and deliberate, some genocide scholars have opted for a more wide-ranging definition, arguing that indirect killing and destruction should also be taken into consideration. This is the case for much of the settler colonial world, where the destruction of native habitat and the spread of European diseases, as well as the direct killing of local inhabitants, led to the dramatic decline of indigenous populations. In this view, the argument goes, if the outcome looks like it's genocide, then it is genocide. Apart from the question of what makes genocide what it is, there is the question of what makes genocide possible. Zygmunt Bauman, a Polish-born sociologist and philosopher, argued that the Holocaust was a direct consequence of modernity and, in particular, the Enlightenment. He argued that totalitarianism was the result of rationalism taken to its extreme, so that the Holocaust was deeply rooted in modern Western civilization. Bauman also argued that several conditions had to be met for genocide to be committed. It had to be driven by a strong, technologically and bureaucratically efficient state. It had to be part of a rational process of elimination, and it had to have an ideological justification as well as a blueprint for creating a new world. Bauman also stressed that once mass political violence is unleashed, it develops its own dynamic and becomes all but unstoppable. For sociologist Michael Mann, on the other hand, genocide occurs in the midst of geopolitical instability and competing ideological projects. It is more about ethnic rivals vying for power. Thus, in the former imperial powers, as well as in the colonial dominations, a form of national homogenization occurs, as the democratic or democratizing state kills and displaces ethnically diverse populations. Both Bauman and Mann believe, however, that genocide is modern and requires an ideological framework, such as a race or religion or class with a wide support base, It also, according to them, requires a technological capacity to kill on a large scale. Many genocides in history, however, do not meet these criteria. The killing of around 600,000 to 800,000 Tutsis in Rwanda in the space of 100 days, around 75% of the Tutsi population, did not require any sophisticated technology. Machetes and starvation were the means used. It was genocide at an intimate personal level, the kind of face-to-face killing that leaves us perplexed by the ease with which it was carried out. One can say the same for the men who belonged to the Einsatzgruppen and the Order police battalions on the Eastern Front during the Second World War. Those groups eliminated over 2 million people, largely by conventional means. Similarly, in Cambodia, it appears that most of the killing was done face-to-face with machine guns, machine pistols and rifles. That seems to contradict Bauman's technologically driven genocide with an ideological rationale. On the other hand, many pre-modern genocides were also framed in terms of religion or ethnicity. The term could apply, for example, to the killing of Cathars, a Christian sect considered heretic, in the 12th century France. What are we to call the destruction of indigenous peoples in the Caribbean at the beginning of the 16th century, if not genocide? It highlights just how difficult it is to determine exactly not only what genocide is, but under what conditions it occurs.